I'm going to go back a couple years in my mind for the beginning of this. Returning by car from what we call our Unitarian Universalist General Assembly, which is our national meeting every year. 2 years ago, it was in Portland, Oregon. And I took my kids up there, and we had a nice road trip up and back. And on the way back, we hooked up with a friend of mine, a lifelong friend of mine who I grew up with and went to school with in Minnesota. And we spent about 3 days in the mountains of Central Oregon, just peaceful and quiet and beautiful, hiking and swimming and spending time near rivers. And on the way back home, we stopped at a small town and a cafe for coffee and a snack mid-morning. And it's funny, my friend and I had been talking about the concept of beauty in the car and how subjective it is. I told him I had been listening to the radio. I love music, and I punch around the dial sometime to just see what's out there. And I came across this piece of music. It was kind of electronica-type stuff, and I listened for a few seconds, and I thought, oh, that's bad. You couldn't pay me enough money to go to a concert where they're playing this kind of music. My skin would crawl. Sure enough, that song finishes on the radio, and the DJ comes on and goes, wasn't that beautiful? And to him, it was. You know? So we had just been talking about this, and we're outside the cafe with our stuff, and there was a beautiful classic car there, like 1940s or 50s, shiny. There was an elderly guy there with a friend of his, and I asked him about the car, and he was happy to tell me about the year, etc., and he opened up the hood, and there was shiny chrome from the engine. You know, it was just one of these classic show cars, and it was a beautiful machine. And then he turned it on, and it went bum, 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 bum. You hear these sometimes, you know, like miticize it, please. But his friend was there, and he got in the car and he revved it up, and my kids could have been blown off their patio seats and the whole, because it was so loud. You could have heard it in the mountains we did just come from. Wow, 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 wow. And he shuts it off, and his friend looks at him and goes, that's beautiful. Now, my friend and I had just spent with my kids 3 days in the quiet mountains of Oregon, and we shared a look like, oh no. So, I tell all this for what reason? We're not talking about beauty today, we're talking about happiness, right? But what's the basic message here? One size does not fit all. Right? Different strokes for different folks, as we say in common parlance. There's other ones. One person's meat is another person's poison. Remember that old little aphorism? And then even the nursery rhyme. Jack Sprat could eat no fat, his wife could eat no lean. And so between them both, you see, they licked the platter clean. So they each had their druthers and their not druthers, but it worked out. So given that beauty like happiness, or happiness like beauty, does not have a one-size-fit-all kind of thing, it might serve us to decide what really makes us happy, and then to shape our lives accordingly, not to anyone else's standard, but to our own. And in the book that I read from The Art of Happiness, Howard C. Cutler interviews the Dalai Lama on just that subject. And he tells us a little bit about happiness, which is that scientific studies show that that happiness has good effect in many levels, like better physical and mental health, longer life, stronger relationships, and greater career success. And he writes that, quote, one of the fundamental principles of the art of happiness is that cultivating greater happiness not only benefits oneself, but also one's family, community, and society. There is new scientific evidence supporting this principle as well. Such evidence helps dispel our common cultural biases and myths, such as perceiving happiness as a somewhat soft or frivolous subject, or considering the pursuit of happiness to be self-centered or self-indulgent. End of the quote. And so in that earlier chapter, The Right to Happiness, I suggest that we accept the Dalai Lama's premise that you have a right to be happy despite the suffering in the world. And in fact, being happy is not only good for you, it's good for others. Now, a vital aspect of happiness is social context. Nothing exists in a vacuum in this world. And I only have so long here, so I've chosen not to focus on that today, but it needs to be mentioned. So I just want to dispense with that now. As it happens, the cover story of the November 2017 National Geographic magazine is titled "The World's Happiest Places." And in it, author Dan Buettner reports that the researchers who publish something called the World Happiness Report each year found that about 3/4 of human happiness is driven by social and cultural factors. Then he writes, quote, "These factors don't materialize by chance. They are intimately connected and related to a country's government and its cultural values. In other words, the happiest places on earth incubate happiness for their people. In many cases, people thrive because the places where they live give them an invisible lift, constantly nudging them into behaviors that favor long-term well-being." And from elsewhere in the article, which holds up Denmark, Costa Rica, and Singapore as places that are great at providing this invisible lift, he says this: "Denmark frequently claims the top spot in the annual happiness report, a reflection of its government-supported education, healthcare, and financial safety net." I'll repeat that. Denmark frequently claims the top spot in the annual World Happiness Report, a reflection of its government-supported education, health care, and financial safety net. So my only question on this aspect of happiness today is this: what might be the opposite of a nation giving their citizens an invisible lift? An invisible drag, one that's profoundly felt as an enervating, anxiety-producing, deeply taxing, soul-sucking energy drain? Enough said for now, but I will return to this in a future sermon, or two, or more. Meanwhile, psychologist Martin Seligman tells of how he was approached by CNN to comment on the state of psychology today. They said he could only have a short sound bite, and he asked, "Well, how many words?" "One." So the camera rolls, and the reporter asks, "Dr. Seligman, what is the state of psychology today?" "Good." "Oh, cut. Cut. Okay, all right. Maybe that won't quite do it. All right, two words." Cameras roll again. "What is the state of psychology today?" "Not good." Okay. Maybe we need three words. And Seligman says, "Not good enough." Not good enough. Dr. Martin Seligman is the professor at the University of Pennsylvania, and he uses this to tell of how for more than 70 years now, the field of psychology operated from a disease model. And this had two main victories. One, more than a dozen disorders once considered untreatable are now treatable. Two, along the way, a science developed, capable of measuring and to some degree accounting for and relieving problems and anxieties. It was good at making extremely miserable or troubled people less miserable, and that's good. But Seligman points out that it forgot about typical, relatively untroubled people. So he developed what's now known as positive psychology, which says that the field of psychology should be just as concerned with strength as with weakness, just as interested in building up the best things in life as in repairing the worst, and with making the lives of, quote, normal people happier, more fulfilled, and more productive. The time must have been ripe because Dr. Seligman was elected president of the American Psychological Association by the largest margin ever at that time. And he tells of how he had studied extremely miserable people to find out how they differ from most people. But now he started to look at extremely happy people to find out if there were differences from the great mass of sort of people who are in between. And he says that happier people are not more religious, they're not wealthier, they're not more attractive, they're not in better shape, they don't have more good events and fewer bad events in their lives, but they have one central commonality. They're extremely connected socially. Now, this doesn't mean that people don't have different temperaments and some people are more introverted, well, that's fine, but he's saying that nobody who was really happy was isolated when they didn't choose to be alone. They had a romantic partnership typically, and they had a group of close friends that they could connect with. And he wants to point out, though, that this is a correlational relationship, not a causal relationship. In other words, the happiest people had romance and friends, but you can't say that those having romance and friends caused them to be happy. But it was a common correlation. And he was talking here about the most sort of basic sense of what we think of as happy, being cheerful, jovial, buoyant, full of life. But he also suggests, interestingly, in his research, quote, that's not nearly enough. And then he and his colleagues began to look at therapeutic interventions across the centuries, as he put it, from Buddha to Tony Robbins. And about 120 different things were proposed that supposedly make people happier. And they studied these and found that, yes, some indeed did. And he summed it up in this passage from his book on the subject, Learned Optimism. Happiness is a scientifically unwieldy notion, but there are three different forms of it you can pursue. For the pleasant life, you aim to have as much positive emotion as possible and learn the skills to amplify these. For the engaged life, you identify your highest strengths and talents and then craft your life to use them as much as you can in work, love, friendship, parenting, and leisure. And for the meaningful life, you use your highest strengths and talents to belong to and serve something you believe is larger than yourself. So just for the last couple of minutes here, I want to share more of what Martin Seligman says about each of these, or what he calls three different happy lives. They're different because you can have one and not the other, or two and not the other, and because different things tend to build that type of happiness. So, number one, the pleasant life. The idea is to have as much positive emotion, and that comes from positive sensation, as possible. And then you build skills like savoring and mindfulness to make sure you get all the juice out of those experiences. But there are two main drawbacks. Positive emotional sense, the idea of pleasure is largely, partly inborn. How we register it, and it's not very modifiable. So if you have a certain baseline, you tend to return to that in just this aspect of happiness. It's only about 15 to 20% of overall happiness. And two, we rapidly become habituated to stimuli. So, for example, if there's a song that you hear and you love it and you want to hear that song a lot, and then 3 weeks later you're like, enough, right? And even if you still like that song, you're not going to get that same rush and juice from it if you hear it again as you did the first few times. We just get habituated to things. That's the way human psyches seem to work. So that's the pleasant life. Now, the engaged life is what he calls, again, finding satisfaction in your career, your parenting, really jumping into those things. And what he says is the most highly satisfying aspect of those is when you get into what's called a state of flow. That's been described as, quote, a kind of intense focus and crisp sense of clarity where you forget yourself, lose track of time, and feel like you're part of something larger. You might get that in an artistic pursuit, in engagement in some art form that you like. There's all sorts of ways, athletics. People describe getting into a state of flow. And so the engaged life is to build your life around your work and play and things so that you're in that flow state as much as possible. And it's distinct from pleasure because pleasure is very sensory, but the flow state is actually described as kind of asensory. You're not really feeling things as much as sort of in another state. And one of the ways to get into there is to measure what he calls your signature strengths. And there's a test you can do at his website called AuthenticHappiness.org, AuthenticHappiness.org, where you can do free tests that will measure and mark your signature strengths. And so the first, again, is the pleasant life. It's positive emotion. The second is the engaged life. We might call that positive absorption, where you're really into things deeply that feed you. And finally, the meaningful life, or what he also calls the altruistic life. And this is the most esteemed of the three happy lives. And it starts with the same way that engaged life does, knowing your strengths. And then the big trick, or the next level, I would say, is to then plug them into something larger than yourself. Philosopher Dan Dennett summed this up in other words: find something more important than you are and dedicate your life to it. That's the essence of the meaningful life. And then Seligman posed the overall question: to what extent does the pursuit of the pleasant life, the engaged life, and the meaningful life contribute to overall life satisfaction? And the results were pretty clear and maybe not surprising. The life of meaning, where you're serving others primarily and plugged into a cause larger than yourself, gives people the most ultimate life satisfaction. Engagement is also strong. And interestingly enough, the pleasant life by itself gave almost no satisfaction, except when meaning and engagement were already strong. Then it was, as he described it, the whipped cream and the cherry on top of everything else. But pursuing the hedonistic pleasant life by itself really gave people no ultimate satisfaction. So what he calls the full life, and what I'm calling happiness from the depths, is the sum of all three. And that sum is greater than its parts. So there's one last piece, which is that if you pursue the engaged life, and if you pursue the meaningful life, those things that tend to give people the most happiness and satisfaction, it's likely that the deeper the happiness you pursue, the more it will be connected to life's adversity. This notion comes from many places, but I found it most strikingly from the German philosopher, poet, composer, and writer Friedrich Nietzsche, who basically championed the notion of no pain, no gain. And in his book, The Consolations of Philosophy, Alain de Botton distills Nietzsche's convictions like this: the most fulfilling human projects appeared inseparable from a degree of torment, the sources of our greatest joys lying awkwardly close to those of our greatest pains. Why? Because no one is able to produce a great work of art without experience, nor achieve a worldly position immediately, nor be a great lover at the first attempt. And in the interval between initial failure and subsequent success, in the gap between who we are and who we wish one day to be, must come pain, anxiety, envy, and humiliation. We suffer because we cannot spontaneously master the ingredients of fulfillment. And I would just insert sort of a broader societal context here. We sometimes suffer socially because we cannot just snap our fingers and change the world in the way that we would hope. Alain de Botton continues, Nietzsche was striving to correct the belief that fulfillment must come easily or not at all, a belief ruinous in its effects, for it leads us to withdraw prematurely from challenges that might have been overcome if only we had been prepared for the savagery legitimately demanded by almost everything valuable. It's quite a phrase. It's a ruinous effect, for it leads us to withdraw prematurely from challenges that might have been overcome if only we had been prepared for the savagery legitimately demanded by almost everything valuable. No pain, no gain. F. Scott Fitzgerald seconded Nietzsche's motion in an amusingly ungrammatical way. Nothing any good isn't hard. Yeah, that spun my head around too. I had to think about that. Nothing any good isn't hard. So we started with the idea that there's not one way to happiness. And I want to suggest that happiness from the depths is finding the right balance for you between pleasure, engagement, and altruism. And then knowing that whatever you pursue, if it's truly rewarding and valuable, it's going to bring challenges. And that doesn't mean you should give up. So as you consider this balance, I'll leave you with one more piece of data from Martin Seligman. He did an experiment where he had people do something fun and then do something altruistic and then reflect on the after effects. And the research showed that after doing something fun, satisfaction drops quickly and stays flat. But when doing something to help another person or a creature, the satisfaction lasts and lasts and lasts. Blessed be, and amen.